This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we are an Informed Decision 2020 panel on how Utah funds public education and Constitutional Amendment G that went before Utah voters in November and passed with 54% voting in favor. Earlier this year, Utah legislators passed HB 357, which promised education funding to match inflation and student growth, expanded use of revenue raised through capital levies, and additional rainy day funds. These changes will go into effect now that Utah voters have approved Amendment G, which expands income tax revenue, currently earmarked solely for education, to include services for children and adults with disabilities. However, this has been criticized by education advocates for diluting the educational funding earmark, potentially leading to future cuts to public education. This is concerning because Utah has ranked last nationally in per pupil spending for over two decades. According to 2018 data released by the U.S. Census Bureau, Utah allocates just $7,628 per student. This places Utah well below the national average between $12,000 and $13,000 and is only a portion of the $24,000 spent per student in New York, the highest in the nation. Today's panel discusses Utah's low per pupil spending, the constitutional amendment changing the income tax earmark, and the ramifications now that it has passed. Today's panel includes Andrea Brandley, Research Associate at the Gardner Policy Institute, Sydney Dixon, State Superintendent of Public Education, Richard Kendall, former Commissioner of the Utah System of Higher Education, Andrew Rohrer, Director of the Utah Education Policy Center, and Representative Steve Eelison, member of the Utah Legislature. The panel is moderated by Natalie Gochner, Director of the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. This forum was put on in partnership with the Gardner Policy Institute and the Alumni Association at the University of Utah. This forum was recorded on September 9th, 2020. Here's your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
Hope everyone's staying safe out there. I'm Natalie Gochner, the Associate Dean of the David Eccles School of Business and Director of the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. We are excited to welcome you to our first Informed Decisions 2020 Issues Forum. It is a major election year, as Ann mentioned, and the Gardner Institute is so pleased to partner with the Hinckley Institute. These are two outstanding institutes at the University of Utah, and we love to educate Utah voters on critical policy issues and better acquaint them with competitive candidates from key races throughout the state. So our panelists today are going to examine the landscape for public education funding so that Utahns can make an informed decision about this constitutional amendment. We have a colleague of mine on the forum today, Andrea Brandley. Andrea is a research associate at the Gardner Policy Institute. And before I introduce the panelists, I'm just going to ask Andrea to share background with you regarding education funding and how it might relate to these HB 357 and SGR 9, which I've outlined. So Andrea, go ahead and share your screen and let's share with our viewers a little bit of data and give them some background here.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Natalie. I'm excited to be a part of the conversation today. So Natalie already gave a pretty good overview of what this amendment is and how it relates to public education funding. I think that's important because when you see the amendment, I'll actually pop it up on my screen. It talks about expanding the use of money from income taxes and property taxes to support children and support people with a disability. It doesn't mention education funding specifically in the ballot question, but it does relate to education funding, as Natalie mentioned, because that income tax revenue is currently earmarked solely for education spending. So that's kind of where the relation comes in. And there's lots of ramifications and reasons for that that we'll probably get into later in the panel, but I just wanted to focus on kind of how public education is funded in Utah and how we compare across states. So you can see in the slide I have popped up that funding public education in Utah is primarily a state and local responsibility. More than 90% of the funding comes from state and local sources. I mean, this is a big deal in Utah, particularly because we have a very large school age population. In fact, we have the largest school age population in the nation. And then as a result of that, we have a smaller working age population. So there's always this balance to be found between maintaining a tax burden that is reasonable while also having enough funding to adequately fund public education. So we often go back and forth between those two issues. And I wanted to just talk briefly about how Utah compares to other states when it comes to funding. So I have several metrics up on the screen, and I do think that it's important to kind of look at several different metrics. They each have strengths and weaknesses. So per pupil expenditures is what's talked about the most often. Utah has ranked 51st by this metric for quite some time, which is likely at least partly due to that large school age population that I mentioned already. But there are other metrics that we can look at when we're comparing states' funding efforts. So another one that is commonly used is proportion of personal income. So this measure is measuring how many dollars per $1,000 of personal income goes toward public education. So Utah ranks 39th by this metric. However, that has actually declined quite a bit over the last 20 or 30 years. If you looked at that metric in the 90s, you would have seen us ranked closer to 20 or a little bit better. In the 2000s, we were ranking near the national average, 25 or 26, and it has now declined to 39. And then percent of own source revenue, this is how much of local and state revenue is going towards public education. We rank 43rd by that measure, and then 39th for percent of GDP or percent of the economy. So I think this just kind of helps to get a general idea of where we stand when compared to other states when it comes to funding metrics. But I also think it's important, if we're going to talk about funding, to also talk about outcomes. So I have the three most common outcome measures up on the screen, and there's caveats to all of these. It's difficult to compare outcome measures across states. So for example, we rank 30th for our ACT score. Our average ACT score is 20.3, which is just below the national average of 20.7. However, not every state uses the ACT as their primary college entrance exam. Other states use the SAT more commonly. So if you look at just the states that have 100% participation on the ACT, there's only 15 of them. And we actually tie for first among those 15 states. So that's kind of an important thing to recognize. And then we rank 20th for our graduation rate. Our graduation rate is around 87% compared to the national average of just over 85%. And keep in mind that graduation requirements can differ across states and across districts. So that's important to keep in mind when we're looking at that measure. And then math and reading assessments is probably the most standardized measure we have for education outcomes. And Utah consistently ranks near the top, in the top third by those metrics. And this is eighth, done at the end of the fourth and the eighth grade math and reading assessments. And then the last thing that I wanted to just briefly talk about before we get the conversation going is just to be aware that these outcomes do vary based on different populations. So we see achievement gaps nationwide, and Utah is no exception to that. So this graph shows in red our economically disadvantaged students in Utah. And you can see that they score consistently lower on all of our outcome measures, whether it's graduation, the ACT, or our math and English proficiency levels. And then we also see a similar pattern when looking at race and ethnicity. So see our American Indian, Pacific Islander, Black and Hispanic students consistently scoring lower than our Asian and white students. So I think that's just important background information to have and to keep in mind as we're having these discussions about education funding and education outcomes. So I'm going to go ahead and pass it back to Natalie, and hopefully that helps set up the conversation that we have today.
Very nicely done, Andrea. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm going to start first with our superintendent of public education, Sid Dixon. And I should mention that we have on our panel today, Sid Dixon, who again is the state superintendent of public education. We have state representative Steve Ellison. Welcome, Steve. We have Andrea Rohr, who's the director of the Utah Education Policy Center. Nice to see you again, Andrea. And then we have a former colleague of mine, Rich Kendall, who's the former commissioner of higher education and education advisor to Governor Leavitt. And I could name a few other things, Rich, but we'll just leave it at that. So Sid, let's go to you first. Andrea laid out some interesting statistics, some great background information. I would just like to give you the opportunity to provide some additional context on funding and what you saw in her presentation.
Thank you, Natalie. And one accomplishment you might add to Dr. Kendall is that he hired me as a young first year principal. So hopefully he puts that on his resume. That was
I do.
Path to leadership. So I appreciate that about him.
He knows talent when he sees it, Sid.
I think Andrea laid out the scenarios very well. And, you know, it's always interesting to look at data and rankings, and we have to add in things like the number of children per capita, number of children per household, number of school age children. So there, you could keep adding factors to that. And I appreciated that she talked about the success that we have on the ACT when compared to those states who all take it. We have changed our assessment system. Unfortunately, we didn't get to administer the assessments this spring due to COVID. We were very anxious as we lean into these more college-bound assessments in our middle school and junior high as well, feeling like we want to really drill down. I appreciate that achievement gaps were highlighted, and our board is really focused on four areas of our strategic plan, and that's where we want to see money targeted. That's early learning. So if you drill down into how many of our students attend full day kindergarten or where it's accessible, how many children attend preschool, do we have childcare? So that's a huge chunk of funding that we're not allocating in our state that other states are. Effective teachers and leaders, we have to talk about what kind of support goes into recruitment and retention. How do we pay our teachers? What kind of support staff do we have in our schools that can help offset achievement gaps? Safe and healthy schools is another area. It's a third area that our board's focused on. And that's really in that social, emotional learning and mental health. I'm so grateful for Representative Ellison, who's on the panel. He has really devoted a lot of energy and given up a lot of his political chips to make sure that we have funding for mental health, but still not enough, as he will tell you. And then we're moving into personalized learning and competency-based learning. So that can really upend how we think about equity, both vertical and horizontal equity in a funding system. So I appreciate the report. I think we've been familiar with that data for a long time. The disappointment is that that needle doesn't move a lot, but there are a lot of highlights in terms of I'm dealing with information from across the country among my peers who have had to cut education budgets by up to 10%. Our legislature was able to pretty much hold us harmless while some programs were cut. 1.7% was added onto the WPU. So I feel like we're in this great space of working very closely with our legislature on funding. We have very targeted spaces that we're working towards increasing funding, but we have to face reality that we have achievement gaps, and we could do much better as a state in many areas. It's great to say we're in the top 10 in science, but it's embarrassing for us as a nation and for us as a state to say, well, we're in the top third, but then to look at how our students of color and our students living in poverty do. And those things take money. So I really appreciate having this conversation. Thank you, Natalie.
Yeah, thank you, Sid. Andrea, you're a researcher. I know, you know, you're going to be really familiar with all of this data and information, but I'd love you to give our viewers just a perspective on how we look compared to other states as we approach these issues.
Thank you, Natalie, and also to Andrea for the report, comprehensive snapshot of what's going on in the state relative to our peers. I think Superintendent Dixon mentioned, for example, the comparison of Utah to other states, for example, on the ACT that test all students. And comparatively, while we do seem to do well within that peer group, overall, the ACT scores, particularly for students of color and students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch, are not comparable to our students who are white. And so we see that wave, if you will, go across almost all achievement measures, whether we're talking about the NAEP scores, which Andrea highlighted, or we're talking about graduation or dropout. Our students of color and students who are English learners, for example, or students who live in and around poverty do not fare as well. And in comparison to other states, there are states that some might consider our peer group who are also doing better, but it must be said that many of them, if not most, are funding education, even their per pupil expenditures at a higher rate. So when we're looking at Utah being, for example, 5,000 behind the average nationally for what we're putting into per pupil expenditures, it does raise the questions and even a larger gap. So 12,000-13,000 between us and the highest spending state in expenditures. It does raise that question that Superintendent Dixon addressed, which is what are we gaining and what are we losing? And who's losing and what are they losing and what are the long-term impacts of that, including things like are our teachers, we focused a lot so far on social emotional learning of our students, which many states are doing, but I would dare to say that we're at the forefront of that part of our reform agenda. But we also have to begin looking at our social emotional learning of educators, teachers, and leaders. With the pandemic in particular, no one's going to walk away unscathed. And so we have to ask that question now of, given the gaps that Andrea and Superintendent Dixon have highlighted and that the State Board of Education has really focused on, in particular the last 6 or 7 years, what's going to happen to that gap and how large is it going to get? And importantly, and this dips into Rich's area, previous area as well, which is what are the short-term and long-term impacts? So we're also seeing gaps in what's going on here as compared to others in terms of access and opportunity in post-secondary education and also in the workforce.
Thank you, Andrea, for kind of drawing that out. I was just hoping as we started this to just get the landscape for funding and outcomes, and then we're going to drill down into the earmark and the amendment.
That was Andrea Rohrer, Director of the Utah Education Policy Center. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing the Informed Decision 2020 panel on public education funding in Utah and what to expect in the November ballot. Here again is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
Steve, Representative Elison, what's the mood on Capitol Hill as it pertains to these issues? I mean, do legislators understand the achievement gap? Do they understand the needs and the hardships that our public education community feels as they try to deliver on the promise of an high quality education for every Utahn?
Well, it's a good question, Natalie. I can tell you that I do. I can't speak for all my colleagues. The one thing about being a part-time legislator is you have lots of data flying past you from every angle, from water policy to environmental regulation to education. So suffice it to say, I'm sure there's much more education that could be shared with my colleagues on the issue of the achievement gap. When I first saw that data years ago, you could drill down by school on the SAGE scores, and it didn't really matter what district you chose, what school you chose, you'd see those same trends. And it really captured my attention because, those schools are, when we talk about per pupil funding, those students are funded at the exact same level per school. And so it raises the question of how do we close that achievement gap? And I know that the State Board under Superintendent Dixon's leadership is completing a study on the at-risk students and what can be done to address that achievement gap even more. We do have a line item funding for at-risk students, and that's something that I think we'll stay tuned to what that report says, and hopefully we'll take action on it, and hopefully we'll have a better idea of what programs can help us effectively close that gap even more.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Rich, we look to you as someone who has such broad experience in education in our state. For our viewers, I believe that Rich has been, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rich, but a teacher, a principal, a superintendent, worked in higher ed, worked in policy advisory roles. Can you just bring us home on this? In other words, when it comes to funding and outcomes, we just wanted to set the stage before we go talk about the earmark. What more would our viewers need to know?
It's a little disappointing, I think, to have been involved in this for as long as I have. I started teaching in 1967. And I think I've been involved in virtually every reform effort since then, although not so much in the Herbert era. So in many ways, we haven't made a lot of progress. And I think we badly need to address some of the issues that have come up. My comments are kind of pre-COVID. That really throws everything into a bit of a spin. But I'm coming to you from Los Altos, California, and here you see the real outcome, I think, of COVID. And it's a street. It's called Camino Real. On the east side of Camino Real are apartments, and vast numbers of workers have no benefits, no health care to speak of, and relatively average education. On the east side, or on the west side of Camino Real, you have the affluent of Palo Alto, Los Altos, Cupertino, so on and so forth. So I'll just make three comments regarding the main issue. One, I remain unconvinced that this is needed. I don't think it's the last and best effort on the part of the legislature to fund education or to really deal with the issues of the state. Number two, I think the amendment is very poorly worded. It opens the door for virtually anything that deals with children or the disabled. And it's so open-ended. I mean, there's no fiscal note that's going to be on the ballot. It's in the voter book. But I wonder how many teachers in the state, how many administrators in the state realize that it has the potential of reducing the education fund by $600 million. That's what the state fund is for that are classified for children and the disabled. But it's not just $600 million. It could be any amount. It could be $1 billion next year. It could be $1.5 billion the following year because it's so vaguely worded. It troubles me that given the achievement gaps, the incredible disadvantage of people of color, that we would think about changing this part of the education fund when there is so much to do. So I think we can do better than this, and I'm really opposed to Amendment G.
Okay, thank you, Rich. One last thing is just a setup, and then we'll talk in more detail about the earmark and the amendment. I want to get a teacher's perspective, and Andrea Brandley teaches at Uinta Elementary School. Andrea, I just want your last comments on funding and outcomes.
Yeah, so I'll kind of switch from my researcher hat to my teacher hat, but I think that the thing that's hard as a teacher is teachers are so immersed in the work that they do that they have less time to focus on issues like this, right? So I think that every teacher wants the best outcomes for their students, and they want the funding there that's needed to do that, but they're just on the ground focused on that work. And I think that especially in this world of COVID-19 that we're now living in, we're facing more funding issues than we likely have before, right? There's so many things that need to be funded that we never thought about, things about like training teachers to provide virtual instruction, things like providing technology and internet access for students and for teachers. Even like simple things that I hadn't thought about till I started preparing my classroom were things like I can't have students share supplies anymore. So I have to buy so many more markers and crayons so that every student can have their own set. So I think that's the reality for teachers, right? They're just on the ground trying to make sure that their students have markers and crayons and that they can be instructed in the most effective way possible. So of course they hope to have the adequate funding to do that, even if it's sometimes difficult to know the best method of getting there.
Yeah, I like your point, Andrea, that we can sit here as policy wonks and talk all about all these different amendments and earmarks and ratios and different things, and teachers are just trying to deliver a great product to their students. Superintendent Dixon, let's go over the history of the earmark. My understanding is that it was in 1946 that Utah earmarked at least all of the tax revenue to public education, and then in 1996, another amendment that allowed higher education spending to be funded from the education fund. Am I getting those about right, Superintendent?
Well, I'm not that old, but yes.
Well, and so the question becomes, what has the impact been of the amendment to use income tax for both public and higher education? Because that was the change that happened during, you know, the leadership of many on the call here, 1996. What do you think the impact of that amendment has been on public and higher education since then?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, we're lucky in our state in that we have a great partnership with higher education. Not everybody can say that in other states, but we do. And yet, every year, it was sort of this collaborative yet competitive battle over funds within the income tax earmark. And I appreciate that early on, our great politicians back in the day decided that we needed to have a constitutional earmark for public education. I think that's really powerful. What's challenging is when the budget comes forward and we see those income tax revenue numbers, we look at one-time funding and ongoing funding. And so a lot of the ongoing gets put into public education, especially in the weighted pupil unit, the basic funding unit for our schools. But there's a lot of one-time money that always goes to higher ed. It's really rare that we get one-time funding. And we see it go into buildings and things that are needed. We're not disparaging higher ed for going after that one time. But for the last several years where we've come to the table with asks around safe and healthy schools, shoring up our buildings, improving technology, some of those things, it continues to shift to higher ed. So it's unfortunate that we've had to compete. As has been stated, there's not enough money. And also, even though it's a stable funding source in terms of being earmarked, income tax revenue is not always stable. You know, it ebbs and flows with the economy. So like everything else, in a good year, we have funding to battle over. But in a bad year where that's our only source, then we also have both seen diminished returns. So it's both a good thing and a bad thing. Great that we really do have this dedicated source, but it's always been a challenge to have to be challenged with each other, or challenge each other rather, as we ask for funding for our needs. And we both have needs. Yeah. All kids deserve it regardless of age in public education, Utah.
Yeah. Andrea Rohr, how common or uncommon are these large earmarks for public education among states? You know, every dime of income tax paid in this state, whether it's corporate or individual, has to go to public or higher education. That's a big earmark. It's trying to show a commitment to education. Do other states do this?
There are several states, a handful of states, that primarily use income tax to fund public education, and particularly in the K-12 environment. I'm not as familiar with all of the cost-sharing methods across tax revenue that come in within all states between public ed, K-12, and higher ed. However, what we know is that the portion that's going to public ed, so Andrea in the beginning mentioned, and it's publicly available, how much is being spent by the state, around 51%, I believe it is, with regard to public education, and then 7 federal, and then the remainder is local, is that how that gets divvied up across states does differ, and with differential impacts. And I think to go back to Steve's point, that what we find is the outcomes aren't always measured in terms of where the funding came from. And so that's a more convoluted conversation than we probably want to have today, determining whether the funding has a causal or correlational impact on student learning, student outcomes, and what outcomes we should be measuring.
Yeah. Representative Elison, I would love you to just describe I'm sorry to keep asking you to speak on behalf of the legislature, so I'll tone that back just a little bit, but to describe the thinking behind sort of the commitment here. Because, you know, we heard Rich Kendall say, you know, I'm opposed to broadening this earmark to include individuals with disabilities and other children's needs. But the legislature was trying to make a promise here, or a commitment, that they would fund student growth, that they would grow budgets with inflation, that they would give schools more flexibility. That's apparently not convincing enough to Rich. What is the legislative perspective there? And maybe we should ask if you supported the bill and the resolution.
I'm on the record on that one. I did support both of those. And I guess what I would say is that there's different perspectives. Before I give the legislative perspective, let me give the perspective of a parent of a child with a severe disability who's currently on a waiting list to receive services. I spoke yesterday or day before with a mother whose child had been on that waiting list for 17 years. And to say that supporting children and education are mutually exclusive, I would say is a complete misnomer. If you look at where some of the current funding goes for children in terms of Division of Child and Family Services, Division of Services with People with Disabilities, some of the child abuse prevention, when we talk about social and emotional learning, if on, let's just say Maslow's hierarchy, you are not having some of your very basic needs met, then if you want to look at achievement gaps, let's pull up the list of special ed, which is not a comparison that's easily made, but we know that some of the pre-K things are a big driver in long-term educational results. So I think another important thing to consider is that a change the legislature made a few years ago is we moved the Office of Rehabilitation Services out from under the umbrella of the state board. That was funding that went for adults with special needs and disabilities, and we moved that into the general fund. So this simply gives the legislature more flexibility. And again, I think it's really critical to think through the perspective of if we're funding children in terms of improving their lives, I think that only benefits them in the educational realm also. And one other perspective is, in an ideal world, yeah, we'd be near the top of the list in education funding, even though there's not a huge correlation between funding and outcomes. And I'm really glad you looked at the outcomes. But if you go back to 2018, question number one, non-binding question number one, that all citizens were asked, do you want to pay more in taxes and have a go at education? That ballot initiative failed. Go back to last December, we tried doing income tax reform. I was one of the few that did not support that bill in the special session, but there was a voter referendum. And the legislature, first thing we did as we came back in January was to repeal that legislation. And so we have to realize that if we want to increase the pot, that does take more money out of people's pockets. And the legislature has heard directly from the people just twice in the past 2 years that they, in a lot of cases, don't like parting more of their personal income for some of these services. So,
yeah. Rich, I can see you're raising your hand, and I'll allow you to do that. And then we want to talk about the actual wording of the question. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, I agree with the representative. I mean, I think taking care of children, taking care of the disabled, it's a very important thing to do, and it's a noble thing to do. I fully support that. There are mechanisms within the state, within our tax structure, focused on the disabled and focused on children, not necessarily school children. But I don't like the idea of going into Andrea's classroom and taking money from her to take care of a state-funded program that is underfunded by the legislature. So I think if there are long lines, the legislature can fix that. They don't have to take money away from schools to do that.
Okay. So if I can just say one comment here that's really critical, that's part of HB 357, that to say we're taking funding from, a classroom, that legislation says that if Amendment G passes, all of the current funding will be moved into the Uniform School Fund only for K-12 students which protects the current base, which just in the last, in one of the great issue briefs that Gardner Institute just issued, showed we've had a 22% increase in education funding just over the past, I believe, 8 years. That protects any of that being used for higher ed and does protect the base. So to say that we're going to kind of rob Peter to pay Paul with this legislation and voter question is not completely accurate.
Yeah, I would just like to respond that we're talking about the difference between the money that is and the money that might be. I think most educators are really committed to the idea that we should make improvements. And here again, I was appointed a superintendent in 1987. House Bill 357 and House Bill 5510, we wrote in 1987 as a superintendent. It's exactly the same. Stabilize the WPU, provide for growth, provide for inflation. It's the same agenda. It just hasn't changed. So we're right back doing the same old thing again. So I'm looking for an investment. I'm a supporter of Lin-Manuel Miranda. He's an American now. He's not going to throw away his shot. But let me tell you, a lot of young people of color are losing their shot. And a lot of kids that are speaking Spanish are losing their shot. And a lot of kids on the other side, El Camino Real, are losing their shot because we're not stepping up to the improvement in public and higher education. Just not happening.
That was Richard Kendall, former commissioner of the Utah System of Higher Education. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
I want to read the amendment language. We have a question. We're going to the questions now that have come in from listeners. We've only got about 20 more minutes here. So the wording is, shall the Utah Constitution be amended to expand the uses of money the state receives from income taxes and intangible property taxes to include supporting children and supporting children with a disability? Superintendent Dixon, can you give us any background on that language? The question that has been asked is, why are there no guarantees? Why is it so broad?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. The House Bill 357, coupling with that, I think is key. So were it just standing alone without that companion, I would feel nervous about the generality of it. I do want to link back to something Representative Elison said, and we look at our students with disabilities. We have huge achievement gaps between our non-disabled students and students who have disabilities. So we definitely consider all those wraparound services and services of support something that can augment their academic achievement. So I think it is really important to note that. And in a way that the broadness does leave some flexibility on the part of the legislature, good and bad, right? So without that 357 that provides some guarantees, if it just was standing alone, I think there would be perhaps too much flexibility, but allows some wiggle room that actually gives the legislature the ability to look at what other services for children, mental health services, for social emotional learning for our students and for our students with disabilities. So it's reliant on people, all languages. And sometimes if you tighten it up too much, then it's too restrictive. And sometimes if it's too general, then it relies on the people at hand. So right now we have a great relationship with our legislature. And I do believe that they are focused on improving education outcomes. But that could change over time, as could the state board or anybody else.
Yeah, thank you, Superintendent. We have a data question that's come in, and I don't know if Andrea Rohr, Andrea Brandley, or if someone else wants to answer this, but we have a viewer who is asking the question, how Utah ranks with respect to teacher pay. Any of you want to take that one? Getting some good smiles. They ask a corollary. They also say, and how does the amount spent on pay to total spending compare with other states. So I think of that as the ratio towards instruction compared to administration compared to other states. Anyone want to give a quick answer to that?
I think Superintendent Dixon can certainly check me on this, and I would welcome that. But with regard to teacher pay, we are among the lowest in the nation. And most people will tie that directly to teacher recruitment and retention. What we find when we actually ask teachers what makes a difference, it's more about the working conditions, their leadership that they have in schools, and the support they have more broadly. So in the same way we're talking about looking at more comprehensive funding or funding more comprehensively for children throughout their lives and educational opportunities today, the want list for teachers is not first and foremost pay. It is important and should not be dismissed, but it is not the first thing. So asking that question that came up in the beginning about what can we do to support educators to meet the needs of the students they have and the children they have and create opportunities is also a relevant question. But we do not fare well in comparison. Superintendent.
Yeah, I would just add in every state, it takes up the bulk of the budget. Any education budget goes towards personnel, but that support staff, bus drivers, custodians, aides, all of those things come out of a budget, the WPU. So it definitely does take up the bulk of the budget, but we continue to be in the bottom quartile definitely for how we pay our teachers.
I'm reminded of how inadequate it is to spend, an hour trying to unpack education spending because it is so complicated. Rich, it looks like you want to add something, and then I got another question for folks.
Sure. I just wondered what the impact has been on the teaching profession over the last 5 years. Are we gaining highly qualified teachers, especially in areas like math and science? Are we making serious gains in hiring mental health workers for schools? Andrea, I don't know whether at Uinta do you have a social worker on staff?
We do have a school counselor. Salt Lake City School District just this last year put a school counselor in every elementary school. So that was a really big improvement, yeah.
Generally speaking, there's not a lot of mental health workers in school. So I'm coming back to that question. Why do we take money away from the income tax fund, the school fund, to pay for mental health workers in a state agency when we can't pay for mental health workers within the schools that we have? It just doesn't make sense. I go out to a lot of schools, and Uinta is a wonderful place to be. But I'd like you to go with me to Clearfield and walk into a school there that's highly impacted by people of color, people in poverty, and ask where the mental health services are. Where are the counselors? Where's the school nurse? None. So the schools are being stretched to do a lot of things, but we're not meeting the needs there. I mean, I agree in doing mental health, but a lot of it should and could be done in schools. Why take money from one source and do it in another state agency? I don't quite understand that. I'm just...
Rich, you and I have known each other for a long time. We've been through some economic cycles together and seen what's happened to education funding. I watched during the Great Recession when they couldn't fund growth. The legislature in this proposal commits to funding growth. And I'm going to go to Representative Elison again to just ask the question, Representative, do you see this as a change of the needle? In other words, like a turning of the needle to show more commitment to spend more on education and add more stability rather than less? I'm assuming you believe that because you voted for it.
Yeah, I know that Rich talked about, that they've been working on passing HB 357 for decades. Well, we just passed it and now we're gonna give the voters the final say on that. So it's written in state code that those funding increases will happen. And that's a commitment that we're putting into state code. So I think that is a very important point to consider. I I don't know if Rich is aware, but in the past 2-3 years, I've been sponsoring bills, the elementary school counselor program. And then in 2019, we passed HB 373, student support amendments. That was $27.2 million of ongoing funding for student services in schools, whether that be nurses, social workers, psychologists, counselors. It was enough for every school to have an incremental FTE in their school. And so maybe you wasn't aware of that, but we have been putting our money where our mouth is in terms of social emotional learning, knowing how critical those things are to a student success and achievement. So when one of our other panelists was asked if they had a position in their school, if the answer was no, I was going to want some answers, because we sent the funding out for those positions. And here's the interesting thing. I work in healthcare at the University of Utah. And one of our great challenges is literally because of that legislation, we're creating shortages of social workers and nurses in the broader healthcare sector. I was in a meeting this morning where we can't find enough social workers to spend the money that the legislature is putting in these important areas. So I know that's a whole completely different webinar on workforce development. I'm sure you're all doing great work on that, yeah. But sometimes it's like whack-a-mole. When we do something good, something else pops up.
Superintendent Dixon, we have a question pertaining to school-based budgeting. What are your thoughts on school-based budgeting? Maybe you can define that for our listeners as well.
Well, depending on what the person asking the question was thinking, I would assume it's how much control is at the school level? And I think that's always a valid question. There's an assumption, right or wrong, that funding doesn't always get to the classroom level. So we have moved to a more finite line item based budget, the way we approach budgeting and the way that our schools report back to us. So we have systems in place now where we can see where the dollars are going. And we are seeing more dollars targeted right at the classroom level. Doesn't mean that it wasn't there before. We just have ways to track that we haven't done in the past. There's very little flexible money at the school level. And this is where some recent legislation has helped. The Teacher Student Success Act gives money directly to the school where they have decision-making power over those funds. The weighted pupil unit, the more funding that goes into that funding source, a district or a charter has more discretion over how to spend that money. So there is a movement to try and, with this particular measure that we're talking about and House Bill 357, to dedicate more money into those flexible local allocations. So to be able to take that money and create a budget at the school level, sometimes that's helpful. But there's also the downside of that, which is you can't get economy of scale if you're doing everything at the school level. So I think we could provide more flexibility at the school level to meet their needs. And that hopefully will continue to come as we shore up some of those flexible accounts. Hopefully that's what the listener was looking for.
Let's let Andrea Rohr respond, and then we'll go to you, Representative Elison, as well.
So just a follow-up and a wondering. So as this conversation's gone on, there have been references to funding levels 10 years ago, and it does raise the question, if in economically restrictive times we are quite conservative and even have a downturn in funding, then we don't have a history nationally, not just in Utah, of being spendy when we're in prosperous times. So there's an opportunity to perhaps ask different questions about how we're spending the money. But I also want to interject into the conversation a recent report by Jason Willis with WestEd, which the legislature commissioned to determine what's going on with school funding in the state of Utah and whether it is equitable and adequate. And the initial report, and for those others on the panel who've read it, is saying that we have questions we need to answer whether or not our funding is going to be adequate. Are we funding schools and districts, for example, in ways that allow all students to raise opportunities and have greater access, particularly for our students of color and students in poverty and English learners? And what is that what does that access and opportunity look like for the long term? And so it seems like there have been general efforts recently to address issues around ed finance in our state and begin asking different and tougher questions. And so my wondering is whether or not we're at a both and state rather or situation rather than an either or, because a number of the services that would be covered by the child and individuals with disability programs, the greater sort of catch all of that, would be about supplementing, not supplanting, but supplementing services that students need that are crucial to the needs of students in the K-12 environment. And wondering if there's some selectivity that might need to happen down the line.
Representative Elison, you had one more point, I believe.
So there's lots of discussion and metrics about how we rank with other states, what the percent increase in the WPU is. Well, it's really important to note that the legislature passes those funds down to the districts on an equitable basis. And I think we're one of maybe only two states that have never been sued based on the equitability of our distribution of funds from the state level. However, that's where the discussion stops. When you start looking by district and by school, how that funding goes out, there's a lot of questions that I think need some focus there. And I've had a few districts that have, under the guise of confidentiality, opened up their books. And I can see that you have two elementary schools and on a per pupil basis, they are not funded equally. One of the things that happens is that you have, let's say a teacher may be teaching in a Title I school, which I've been to the Title I schools around the state and around the country, and they face a lot of different challenges that a teacher in a non-Title I school may not face. When the opportunity for that teacher that's higher in the salary schedule and tenure to move to another school that may not be as impacted by these other issues, they transfer and there goes their salary and their experience. And so I think we need to have greater attention on how are we spending those funds after they leave the legislature and move into the district level, especially if we're talking about closing the achievement gap. And I know this is going to be a very difficult conversation to have.
Andrea Brandley, we have a question that's come in, and if you don't know the answer to this, we can do something on the Gardner website to answer it. But we have a listener who's asked whether the education spending data per pupil amounts includes amounts spent on capital, equipment, buildings, new computers, new football fields.
Great question. And I don't know the answer for sure, so I don't want to say, but I can look into that and check for sure. I do know that there are major differences when we're looking at expenses that include capital expenses versus not, in addition to which funds school districts are allowed to spend on capital expenses versus other expenses. So it's a great question to ask.
Andrea, do you mind giving your email? This person can reach out to you.
Yeah, feel free to email me and reach out to me. My email's on the Gardner website, and then I will happily answer that.
Rich, yeah. We'll go to you. Oh, it looks like, Sid, do you have an answer to that?
I do. It is not included. And now there are comparisons with capital included, and we end up being in about the same boat. And the capital funds are local funds, and that's where the inequities come in based on the ability to raise revenue. And Representative Elison can speak to how they've tried to equalize that through a variety of measures. But the current comparison that was spoken to earlier does not include capital expenditures.
That's great. Okay, Rich, one more point from you, and then I got one question for everybody to answer before we wrap this up.
I wanted to just say that capital expenditures normally are not included, so I'm just echoing what Sid said. There are some other things that I just want to mention, and that is I think the general fund has been under attack. I mean, reducing revenues and so forth. But there is a very large earmark in that fund, and maybe Representative Elison would like to talk about it. We take $600 million right off the top to pay for roads out of the general fund. And if you look at the tax history, there's literally hundreds of tax exemptions that the state provides for mining equipment, tools, airline fuel, hay farms. I think it deserves a hard look. But that happens with the general fund. And by the way, Representative Ellison does wonderful work. I'm aware of the work that he's done. It's great.
Okay.
I think for sake of time, I could address that question, but I don't think we have enough time. So it's a valid question.
Yeah. Okay. It's just, when you are making a lot of decisions about a lot of important state needs, there's going to be a lot of perspectives. Here's the last question, everyone. We have to end this on time. It's the Hinckley Radio Hour, so we've only got 4 minutes. I want to do a hypothetical with all of you. I want to invite each of you, and you can provide the proper nuances you need to, but we have an open gubernatorial seat. Chris Peterson is the candidate on the Democratic side, Spencer Cox on the Republican side. The hypothetical is that you're preparing them for a debate where this topic is certainly going to come up. What bit of advice do you give the candidate that you're informing about how to respond to voters on whether they should or should not support Amendment G? And we're going to give Superintendent Dixon the last word. So we'll start with our teacher, Andrea Brandley.
Oh, man. Okay. So I think that the first thing that I would say, and this is the biased teacher's perspective, is that I would love for the focus to be, I think that many of us agree that we want to see a greater commitment to public education, and that the devil's in the details, and we can argue a lot about how to make that happen. But it does seem to me that this seems like that's what's happening, that this goal here is to provide a greater commitment to public education. And then hopefully from that point, we can continue to have these discussions about the best way to make
that. Rich, what do you do in the debate prep? We've got about 3 minutes for everybody.
Well, I remain unconvinced that that Amendment G is a way to go. I think 357 is great, and I think the companion bill is great. Those both should be passed. I'm not sure that the amendment is required. I'm a skeptic of it.
Got it. Okay. Andrea Rohr from the Education Policy Center, what do you do in a debate prep?
First, you correct misinformation. So the first thing I'll do is say that the USBE commissioned the Ed Finance study, not the legislature. So that's first. Second, my recommendation would be for the candidates to be informed and be able to talk about the nuances and what the differences are between passing and not passing, as well as how this is part of a longer term plan for adequately funding education and the needs of students throughout the state of Utah.
Representative Ellison, I don't know if you get involved in debate prep, but what would you do to the candidate you're advising? What advice would you give them?
I would tell them to try to make it as simple as possible, which is very difficult in education funding, but that, the basics are that it puts protections in place for education funding that we've never had before, and that funding children and people with disabilities is not mutually exclusive with improving educational outcomes. I would say it's actually synergistic. And so I guess that would be my advice if in the speed round.
That's great. Superintendent Dixon, you get the last word. We've only got about 20, 30 seconds.
All right, thank you. So I would just say that focusing on being very principle-based, so maintaining stability in education funding, we've had this great constitutional earmark, so how do we make sure that whatever we pass, that we have these guarantees going forward, and we try to make good investments and increase education funding over time. Just being very principle-based and understanding the goals and what we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish, and will our current funding mechanism get us there, or can we improve on that?
Thank you, Superintendent. I want to thank our panelists. You all have been terrific, really, a good discussion. We've shown the complexities. We've shown some of the different ways that you can look at these things. Loved hearing a perspective of a teacher, of a legislator, of a longtime educator, of someone who's currently in the role of informing our state. So thank you so very much.
Thanks, Stanley.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. Thanks for listening.